Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again for part 3 of the Delphi Murders. In this episode, I want to talk a lot more about the architecture of the bridge, as I think I'll be able to guide you through a step-by-step evolutionary process that dictates the structure of Bridge Guy's approach. But before we do that, let's consider the father-son cycle that I detailed in the previous episode, in which father and son continue to alternate with the father above the bridge and son below it. It just keeps going around and around in a cycle. Now, with that in mind, what theory came to bear from the symbolic resonance of that idea? Well, that a father-son pair committed this crime, and that the father was above the bridge and the son below. And that began from a rumor that they were communicating with one another from, again, up above and down below, which, of course, is exactly how that takes place in a biblical manner through Jacob's ladder, Jesus communicating with God from down below to up above. At the 2019 press conference, authorities released a new sketch of the suspect, and it was shockingly different than the previous one. Not surprisingly, the first sketch, or composite, was a middle-aged man who looked like someone's father, and the second one was a very young man who looked like someone's son. People started speculating that the young man in question was someone commonly referred to as DP, a witness who changed and/or recanted his eyewitness sighting of Bridge Guy multiple times after coming forward initially, and the older sketch was apparently his dad. And now, moving forward into the future, we've picked up a new set of father-son suspects in the form of Tony Klein and his son Keegan Anthony Klein, or Kagan, however you want to pronounce it. But look how that paranoia involving DP was born, even if it came from legitimate sources suggesting DP's behavior was suspicious. Law enforcement said the first sketch was no longer the primary sketch. That designation belonged to the new sketch of the young man who looked nothing like the older guy, leading some to believe there were two people involved, two suspects. The latest indication from law enforcement is that the young sketch, or newer one, is the killer, while the older sketch, with the older man, is now considered secondary. Look at that construction, a younger man and an older man, potentially father and son. It's been 3 years since they dropped that sketch, and I'd be naive to suggest the investigation doesn't seem to be trapped in an abusive cycle of ignorance since that time, at least from a public viewpoint. We started with a man deemed 5'6" tall and middle-aged by a confirmed witness, and who appeared to be that person in the first image of Bridge Guy that was released. He was a stocky man, perhaps 5'6" tall, with thick legs and a wide waist, along with a belly. And as time goes on, and they give us more, Bridge Guy suddenly turns into Slender Man in comparison to what he originally looked like. Now he's taller, with his legs seemingly thinner, and while most of us believe we're looking at a middle-aged man, law enforcement wants us to believe he's not. They tell us he's between the ages of 18 to 40 when he looks like he's over 40. And in a case where the guy in the video looks like the sheriff, and the sheriff was named a suspect immediately in the case, should he have been at the helm of this investigation? It's not a question I'm qualified to answer. I'm not aware of what else is known about the suspect inside the confines of law enforcement. When I saw the 2019 press conference and knew nothing about the case, other than the horrifying murders of two girls took place, one look at the sheriff, my first look, had me saying, that's Bridge Guy. It certainly does not mean he is. But why has this father-son narrative, mired in stagnancy, become an abusive cycle in which the truth can never seem to escape, except into the clutches of time, from which, eventually, it won't return? DP is not Bridge Guy. Neither is his father. Keegan Klein, not Bridge Guy. Neither is his father. This case will continue to be poisoned by that cycle of father and son until someone goes within and breaks it. That problem is not coming from the outside. That problem is coming from within. Only somebody within the investigation can poison it in that manner. And that means the person who committed this crime, who suffered at the hands of his father as a child, and is seeking transcendence through sociopathy, is very likely a member of law enforcement involved in this investigation. And with that said, wouldn't you know it, the sheriff is immediately made a suspect based upon the fact that he looks just like Bridge Guy. I see the same strategy in the investigation that exists in the perpetrator's narrative. A father-son cycle of transcendence where the killer moves on and leaves everybody else trapped within the darkness and silence of ignorance for years, like he was when he was abused and ignored as a child. The first question we should be asking is why the investigation is poisoned with that notion. Why is it inside the investigation? Why has it poisoned the minds of the public, who's also investigating this from the outside? Why does the public keep indulging these silly father-son narratives? None of these father-son combos committed this crime, but we will keep following that narrative again and again and again because we are trapped within the cycle. The best thing to do is not continue to tumble around and around like a load of laundry, but to stop the cycle, to break it, to open the door to the light and make that thing stop turning. Okay? So that's what I'm going to try to do in this case. The perpetrator is telling us that nobody knew who had killed the child inside him. This was a family secret. I shouldn't see that father-son cycle present in the investigation. But I do. And I know all of you see it as well, because everybody keeps going down the path of the father-son combination. They can't stop. We have two sketches of two different people who look like father and son, but neither of whom looks anything like the man in the Bridge Guy video. For 2 years, the first sketch came up empty. In the 3 years subsequent to that, the second sketch has proven to be equally ineffective. The most likely reason for that result is that the killer is neither of the men featured in the sketches and is instead, and I know this is hugely speculative, but maybe the killer is actually the guy he appears to be in the video we have of him walking unobstructed in broad daylight. Perhaps we could examine the totality of frames in the video, and even the video itself, and admit that the man featured in the video is not either of the men offered in the public sketches. Those sketches are absolute bullshit. They do not look anything like the man in the video. And if you're telling us the man in the video is the killer, well, why are we still seeing these sketches? And the reason is that they are trying to poison your minds with the father-son narrative, because that is what the perpetrator is hurting from. So how did that narrative get into the investigation? There is only one way, and that is that a member of law enforcement is Bridge Guy. I wish I could say I was just making this up and I was just going off the cuff, but law enforcement clearly agreed with me by making the sheriff, the man who looks like Bridge Guy, a suspect. I believe they did not have evidence on him and moved on. And we are trapped in that cycle and will be right into perpetuity unless someone goes inside this case and breaks the cycle. It is not about finding a piece of information related to another man down the line that we don't know about. They have already talked to this dude. They know who the suspect is. They need evidence, and don't have it. And the case will not be solved by looking at other people. It will be solved by going within the circle, within their own, and breaking that cycle, turning the circle into a straight line, letting the truth out. So are we not getting an admission forthcoming from law enforcement because the man leading the office in charge of the investigation looks like the suspect in the Bridge Guy video? Why will law enforcement not admit that the two sketches are not the killer? We can clearly see that in the video. Again, there is absolutely no way for anyone to make a positive ID of Bridge Guy by way of the video. But ask yourself, why is there no transparency here? After 5 years, the public deserves to know why the primary sketch looks like some young dude trying to score ecstasy at a rave instead of an older guy carrying extra weight, when the video doesn't support that. The dude in the sketch is not the guy in the video. Why doesn't law enforcement release a close-up of the man known as Bridge Guy? Again, I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but in all honesty, the close-up frames often look a lot like the sheriff if we're considering publicly known POIs and suspects. It looks just like him. The closer you get to the face, the more it looks like him. Think about this. Law enforcement is perfectly willing to make composites and sketches based upon eyewitness sightings, even if they're not confirmed and turn out to be lies. And they're willing to show you the video at a distance, but they want no part of creating a sketch or composite of what the close-ups of the footage reveal. Are they perfectly clear? No. Are the motivations and memories of eyewitnesses clear? That's also a no. But the video is the best eyewitness they have, by far. And it does not show that young man they depict in the sketch. I knew it 3 years ago, but waited to even say anything, and simply because I could. I could wait another 5 years if I wanted. This case is not going anywhere until they go back and break the cycle of abuse coming from within the investigation. We're in a place right now where you really don't want this case to get older, to let it go unsolved, because maintaining momentum and the dedication of law enforcement becomes more difficult as hopes fade and resources go toward potentially more fruitful endeavors. Why is there not more of an effort to promote the actual image of the perpetrator from the video? It will offer no less clarity than the sketches afforded by the witnesses. But here we are being told to look at the person's mannerisms and gait to see if we recognize them, or even his voice, in a video and audio that's been processed so many times over, the movement looks like Babe Ruth circling the bases after a home run in 1923, and the sound of him talking might as well be anybody at all. The question again is this: why is there such a reluctance to focus on the face of the suspect in the video, especially close up, when in fact it's the most pertinent key to unveiling the person's identity? They cannot tell us it's due to the potential lack of clarity creating a misleading profile, as the witnesses have offered the case 5 years of that same reality to this point. They even used a bullshit composite. What could be worse? To be honest, I'm not sure I want to know the answer to that question, and simply due to the potential for that answer being that they are avoiding the facial aspects of the suspect because, as they deemed, and so did I, he looks like the sheriff. He was made a suspect, and it wasn't based upon a quick glance at somebody's stash. They have seen close-ups of this perpetrator, as have I, and they have had my same suspicions. They made him a suspect. I am, however, not privileged to information beyond the notion that he has been covered, aka cleared, How do you think that term got started in this case, using the word covered instead of cleared? I absolutely guarantee you that it's because of him. Because they can see him in the video and they don't have any evidence. So they are calling him covered and not cleared, just like everybody else. And again, they have more than we've seen in terms of video. Supposedly 43 seconds and more than we've heard in terms of audio. Much more audio. And the sheriff was made a suspect based upon that increased awareness law enforcement possessed through greater evidence than the public. They know more than you do, they know more than I do, and they made the sheriff a suspect immediately. There's a reason for that. So I ask, why is there a reluctance to show the suspect's face up close, even if it isn't with the greatest of clarity? And the answer is that we know what they saw. It's a fact confirmed by the sheriff. They saw him. So clearly, they know we're going to see the same thing. I do. In all of the close-ups I've seen online, even if they are slightly modified due to pixelation considerations, I see Sheriff Tobe Lesenby in the Bridge Guy video. And I believe I can see exactly why they're hesitant to release any type of close-up and focus on other areas. And I believe that reason is because it will present as Sheriff Tobe Lesenby. Let me just say that the resemblance is enough that I am, for the first time, terrified to release a podcast episode. That is not a good thing. All it would take for law enforcement to nullify such suspicions about the sheriff is to offer the public a bit of transparency about the process of him being made a suspect and how he was cleared. But we don't get it. And we don't get any close-ups. We get excuses about the integrity of the images being compromised, but then they take the word of some desperate clown who just wants to put himself near the crime scene to be cool and important, and suddenly make him a suspect and tell us he's the killer, even though he is clearly not the guy in the video you're also telling us is the killer. There is so much bullshit going on here. I believe they knew who it was immediately. I believe they interrogated the sheriff, gave him a polygraph, and remained suspicious, but there was simply no evidence. There are so many yes and no equals maybe cycles tumbling around in this case that they could open a fucking laundromat for psychological abuse. This is not helpful. It is abusive. What they are doing to the public is abusive. It's derivative of someone intentionally fostering such an environment like an abuser does in his house. It feels like a brainwashing, as though they're suggesting what we need to see instead of doing everything they can to be truthful. And if we're living in that abusive house, we have to ask, who's running it? Who's dad? Right? And the answer, the person in charge of the case, who looks just like Bridge Guy, is Sheriff Tobe Lesenby. It's hard to say these things. But after 5 years of seeing the fucking guy in broad daylight, full head-to-toe video, isn't it time law enforcement became just a little more transparent with the public? There's a video of the suspect walking in bright daylight. The people who know who he is aren't talking, and one would have to wonder why they're so afraid of him. In a recent episode, when I talked about psychological abuse, I spoke of abusers creating a situation predicated on yes and no equaling maybe, such as the sweet and sour method in which you alternate affection and abuse. Trapped in a cycle of yes and no, a person remains perpetually hopeful by alternating values of transcendence and irony. You get the abuser's love and then their wrath in a cycle, draw you near, push you away, so you'll remain stuck in that place. An abuser uses those positive and negative charges like the universe, alternating back and forth from Jekyll to Hyde, gentleman to monster. And those two sketches, that law enforcement have provided to you are used exactly for that purpose, to keep you trapped between, to keep you stuck within that logic, in his house, like he suffered when he was a child. So ask yourself, whose house is this? So the way the process works is that in the sweet phase, the abuser behaves like a son seeking a mother's affection. And in the sour phase, he behaves like a father who refuses to approve of her so that the abused believes she both needs him and he needs her. So she stays, stuck there, trapped between the abuser's adulthood and childhood, indulging him as both a man and a child. That's because he's a man-child, a kid emotionally trapped inside a man's body. An abused woman most often acts as mother and lover of the abuser, alternating roles in a never-ending cycle because her man is trapped on the border between the two places emotionally. One foot in adulthood, one stuck back in childhood. Like I said, she indulges both the father and son, who are one and the same, or two halves of the same whole, as I mentioned previously. Again, we shouldn't see that logic being utilized in this criminal investigation. It is. Why? How did it get there? In what manner did the logic begin that suggested having father and son sketches, so to speak, was a good idea? What abusers do is employ reversals. They gaslight you and leave you speechless. At the 2019 press conference for the Delphi murders, law enforcement unveiled the second sketch of the dude looking for Molly at the rave, a reversal, and then what did they do? They literally stopped talking, walked off, and left us ignorant. They said they wanted to spend the following 2 weeks processing new leads, of which there would be many. And in that time, they would not have any contact with you. You would only get silence. Fair enough. But when your suspect goes from a middle-aged man to what appears to be a teen, there is something called explaining yourself, even if the information is sensitive. There are ways to be brief and discreet. Instead, we got darkness, silence, and 3 more years of bullshit to add to the 2 that preceded the press conference. You should expect many more as long as the abusive cycle is not broken. 5 years already. In a case in which it appears the killer is not only a local, but is probably still in the community and was captured on video in daylight. I hate to say it, but there is something obviously wrong here. The most likely reason this person hasn't been definitively identified is that people are afraid to talk. I would ask why. Because, again, if I lived in that town and had a tip after watching that bridge guy video, I don't think there's any chance I'm leaving that tip with the sheriff's office. I wonder how many people with real information feel the same. I'm inclined to believe the suspect knows that. If I'm uncomfortable making a podcast about this, how uncomfortable are people who truly have significant information to offer in order to help the case? I can't answer that or speak for everyone, but it's something to think about. In such a small town, with a killer seemingly so familiar with the terrain and geography, one who gets caught on video, why do we have a situation in which not one person with the ability to identify him will talk? I want to believe he's been identified, and they just don't have the necessary evidence to arrest him. It would probably take somebody recanting a potentially false alibi. But given the problems verifying alibis the first time around, I just wonder if the actual killer managed to use one that was false. I think there's a strong likelihood. In fact, it's probably almost a certainty. So please consider all of that, and now we're going to delve into the bridge architecture. My usual listeners know that I've talked about the act structure of evolution in the form of building blocks. If you make three stacks of two blocks with a single block centered on top of them, what you essentially have is the architecture of birth, life, death in a binary or disunified universe, with the last single block on top representing our deification. So the bottom pair of blocks are birth in the binary universe, or Act 1, which we are closing out right now at 13.77 billion years into a 14 billion year first act. The universe is expected to exist for approximately 42 billion years, according to some, making three equal acts of 14. That number, of course, is derived from the same formula mentioned, and with consideration for the universe being binary in that regard. If you have 14, you get 7, meaning 7 on each side. That accounts for the structure of birth, life, death, adding to 6, and the deification stage, or return to the singularity, remains a single block. So again, it's birth, life, death in a binary universe, or 6, and the deity stage makes 7. That's how you get the lucky number 7. If you take that construction of the 7 blocks and match it with the same on the other side in a binary format, it will form a perfect hourglass. In the hourglass, time goes forward and backward, but in the same direction, like it does in the infinite loop. Yet here, it's powered by gravity. The two sides of the hourglass are called mirror universes. As time runs out in one universe, its mirror universe on the other side is being created with that same time, but in the form of sand. Anyhow, the deification stage is a place where you arrive at the end of the bridge, or our ultimate evolutionary destination, so to speak. There is no bridge beyond that place, in the same way we see there is no bridge beyond the culmination where Libby and Abby ended up on the southeast side. In many religious narratives, this is the place where an individual meets the Father, or Creator, the White Light, also known as the Truth. The moment of universal truth is the only truth, as deception is a design element intended to pace our understanding of it. Only in the place where the bridge ends can one be sure of the truth. And the truth very specifically equates to the identity of the Father, or God, the Creator, in addition to his motives. Who is the Creator, and why was this universe created? That is available only at the moment we reach the culmination of the evolutionary pathway, or search for universal truth, called the bridge. Again, when the Creator himself must be unveiled as truth at the end. So in this tragic narrative involving anti-heroes instead of heroes, we understand that the place to which this excursion is headed is universal truth, but not by way of God, rather by way of the devil, or darkness from down below, not the white light above. Our Creator in this story is the killer. He's the narcissist who created this narrative. The devil, the darkness, the unknown lying in wait in the abyss below the bridge, if you descend. And unlike God, so to speak, who would be waiting for you to unveil the truth of the white light, the devil comes from below, which for an adult equates to their past in childhood. So in this story, I believe Libby and Abby were likely trying to be casually late for a meeting with a guy they expected to be at the end of the bridge when they got there. The bridge apparently takes 10 or 11 minutes to walk across, give or take, and the last photo they snap is at 2:07 p.m. So I think they, or at least Libby, had set a meeting with someone in secrecy in which she intended to arrive at the end of the bridge around 2 p.m., but wanted him to be waiting for her. However, from a structural standpoint, the devil is from your past, the childhood down below in your unconscious mind. So in this Delphi narrative, our predator, an older man who turns out to be someone other than she expected, was really the devil in disguise. And so, since he's from the past, he approaches from behind her instead of waiting for her there. So he comes from behind, or the past, literally lurking over their shoulders and coming closer, closing in by the minute, because this incident was derived from trying to shortcut evolution due to an emotional problem from the past. This is how that man's father kept creeping up on him from behind, from the past, trying to kill him. And so because it was happening to him emotionally, he projected it onto them physically. The girls weren't supposed to be out there meeting an older guy in secrecy. But I think that's what happened, and by way of catfishing, most likely because Libby was trying to fill an emotional hole from her past, which made her vulnerable to this type of incident. When a child predator connects with a kid online, they try to foster the same darkness and silence of the abusive environment in which they grew up. It works so well in the sweet part of the sweet and sour phases of the abusive cycle because the predator is giving the child a lot of positive attention that seems too good to be true. When two people share secrets like this, it creates a strong me and you vibe, like there's no one else in the world, like you're suddenly the only important thing to him, something you've always wanted to feel. And the child begins to absorb the obvious yet underlying notion that if the silence is broken through carelessness, that feeling is going to end because the relationship, in order to exist and be facilitated, needs to remain a secret. That's the key. Again, I don't know if that's what happened in the case, but I'm assuming, due to the precise nature of the attack, that the killer went to meet them. And despite the girl's intention for him to arrive first, for them to be casually late so that he's waiting on them, making that feeling of courting Libby, he actually comes from the back, over their shoulders, closing in because, again, it's a manifestation of an emotional wound from the past. His father, on an emotional level, wouldn't stop coming up behind him, trying to kill that child inside. That's what predators look for online. Kids hurting like they once were, and still are. But now they're going to get revenge by putting themselves in the role of the abusive father and abusing another child who, in some way, reminds them of themselves at that age. As the quote-unquote affection they received was corrupted, so too will that innocence be corrupted in the chosen victim. That's the pinnacle for these creeps. They want to, like their abusers did to them, unveil themselves as someone other than the child thought they were, and when the child realizes it, it's too late. They're trapped, unable to escape. They'll be stuck in that place forever as kids. And so the killer is going to do that to them physically as revenge. That's the emotional life of the killer. He projects it physically onto the victims. His past won't stop coming up behind him, haunting him in a place where he feels like he could fall and never stop falling. He takes his emotional world and places it atop this railroad trestle to tell us the truth. When he reached the midpoint, the transition point between childhood and adulthood, he was not able to transcend, aka go past the midpoint of the bridge, without his father haunting him from the past. He was not able to move on because he needed to kill the child that the father was still chasing. And so he's come here to do it symbolically. He doesn't want that man over his shoulder any longer. Anyhow, As I said, there are 6 building blocks, and then the deification stage at the end, which is 1 block. That's the place where you arrive at the end of the bridge. That block is in the middle of the ones below it, while they stick out to the periphery because unification is reached at the end. In the meantime, the way evolution works is that, like switchbacks, irony and transcendence, or yes and no, right and wrong, light and dark, conservative and liberal, must alternate like the electrical current that facilitates what we see in front of our eyes as the universe, in addition to everything we can't see. So on this Monon High Bridge, we have 3 platforms jutting out from each side along its length, spaced in a right-left zigzag pattern regardless of whether you're going northwest or southeast. They're staggered like that from a symbolic standpoint to represent the switchbacks of evolution, or reversals, meaning the alternation of 2 sides, such as light and dark or right and wrong. We have 6 platforms, like the 6 building blocks of birth, life, death in a binary universe, and then the culmination at each side is the equivalent of the deification stage. And again, symbolically, they're going north to south, so this path doesn't lead to God, it leads to the devil. And the devil is from the past, behind them, over their shoulders. He comes from prior to the transcendence point. So what it says here is that the killer is haunted by his father following him into adulthood. And that would obviously be because his father was abusive to him in childhood. And so in order to get rid of the father, what he has to do is symbolically become him and kill the child. That way, the father no longer has anything to chase. And at the end of this story, that's what we see. The father, so to speak, kills the children. Now, due to the construction of those platforms, we know the halfway point of the narrative, commonly referred to as the point of no return, is approximately the halfway mark across the bridge, or when passing the 3rd of 6 platforms. Again, we have birth, life, death, and a binary universe, making 2 halves of 7 for a total of 14. So when we see the last photo of Abby on the bridge, it happens at exactly 2:07 p.m. to symbolize the 2 sets of 7 making 14. And she's crossing the 3rd platform, meaning she and Libby, who is ahead of her, have crossed the point of no return. So that point of no return, the midpoint passing the 3rd platform, means that from a structural standpoint, it is inevitable that the killer is going to appear now, because that is when his father appeared in his life, when he crossed the transcendence point going from child to adult, or in the midpoint, the point of no return, his father followed him. And he did it emotionally, and so what he's going to do is compensate by doing it to them physically. So they've reached the midpoint. So if you recall, we placed a straight line across the bridge, and then we put a circle around that straight line. And so we have a semicircle going over the top and a semicircle going down below. And so what that's going to create is the equivalent of both the unconscious mind below and conscious mind above. Jesus below, God up top, childhood below, the Father on top. Right? So we're going to have that bridge as the transcendence point between the 2 halves of the same whole. Now, looking at that bridge and knowing that what we have to do is extract the circle in favor of making the circle straight lines in our evolutionary narrative, meaning going from 1-0 to 1-1, what happens is we have to turn the straight line into crossing straight lines, and then at that point, you will have to remove the circle. Okay? And so you have the redundant 1-1, but they will cross. So now you have your circle with the straight line as the bridge through the middle. Now take another straight line, right, from the top, and run that straight line down through the middle of the other one, making a cross. What you should have is 2 crossing lines, like a crucifix almost, and a circle around them, which creates crosshairs. So if you create crosshairs on the bridge, what will be the target? What will be the point at which those crosshairs meet? And the answer is right at that place where they take the picture, which is the midpoint, or point of no return. So again, those straight lines will align in the middle at the intersection of the seeker and the sought. And so that's why Bridge Guy appears at that moment. Once they pass that point, here he comes. Now, in some religious narratives, people walk on water. But as I exemplified earlier, we mere mortals are given narratives conducive to greater practicality. So in this story, the place at which we have the intersection of the seeker and the sought is supposed to be in the middle. It is here either the devil or God reveals himself. In our evolutionary narrative, which requires reverse engineering our universe back to the point of universal truth, or deification, we go back to the center, or the point of origin on the bridge, aka the Big Bang. But when nature recreates such a narrative on a bridge, with people, in three-dimensional terms, practicality negates everyone merging at the center of the bridge and the incident occurring there. So this is where the devil, so to speak, will initially come into view. When Libby takes that picture of Abby at 2:07 p.m., we don't see anyone else in the background on the bridge yet. But what becomes apparent is that she stops turning around to take more photos after that point. She took a low-angle shot of the length of the bridge early in the crossing, and then a photo of Abby at the midpoint. At that time, Bridge Guy does not seem to be following them yet. But due to the circumstances that arise, and the fact that, as far as we know, Libby didn't turn around to take any more photos, one could easily assume her reason for doing so is that the man would have been behind them and walking at a significant pace that allowed him to gain ground on the girls. I don't think she wanted to stop to take more photos or even take the chance that the man lurking over their shoulders would be offended by ending up in the shot if she did. Now, let's examine the practical reason for the middle of the bridge being the point of no return. If the girls reach the midpoint of the bridge and cross it, as Bridge Guy suddenly appears at the other end where they started, then it becomes a situation in which they should continue heading to the other side. Not only is the trip back then longer than the one to the end of the bridge, but if you turn around, you'll come face to face with the devil that's been lurking over your shoulder. So what happens is you keep going, to the place where he needs you to be, in position to go down the hill, or the side of the circle, into the abyss below. So for practical reasons related to navigating a 3D world as a human, he first reveals himself at the intersection of the seeker and the sought, or midpoint, but actually intersects with them at the end of the bridge. If there is anything he wants to avoid, it's conflict on this bridge. The most efficient way to handle it is to let the girls go halfway, reveal yourself behind them, and naturally allow their suspicions and the practicality of continuing to go forward after passing the midpoint to prevail as sound logic. Meanwhile, as happens in tragic narratives, the trap you set for them comes to fruition so easily because it's truly the one they set for themselves. The analogy I used earlier was that this guy was luring them into the web in the absence of his presence, and then revealing himself as the spider approaching once they were trapped. Now, since he's the father, so to speak, even if coming in the form of the devil, his revelation, meaning the video Libby took of him, and which has been viewed in public, should happen when he crosses the sixth platform. The deification stage happens after the binary stages of birth, life, death, 2, 4, 6, and then the singularity. So the father should appear, so to speak, the father should reveal himself, even if in the form of the devil, after crossing the sixth platform. platform. So when the girls cross the third platform, the midpoint, it's the point of no return. And that is when he's going to disallow them from returning. But after passing the sixth platform, meaning you've completed birth, life, death in a binary universe, or six building blocks, the seventh, the deification stage, is simply the revelation of universal truth, or the white light, or the identity of the Father, what is often referred to as God, or the Creator. So when this man crosses the sixth platform, what happens? He's revealed. Anytime this structure is mimicked, it will implore the same values due to structural inevitability. Now, let's talk about that infamous Bridge Guy video. We're given a very short clip, perhaps what amounts to something between 1 to 2 seconds of footage, which shows Bridge Guy, believed to be the killer, walking atop the Monon High Bridge at a good pace, considering the railroad ties on the old trestle are a bit weakened, warped, and on occasion, missing. A train hadn't gone over the bridge for decades before the murders, and the rails had seemingly been removed from the structure, allowing people to walk across it more easily and safely, whether that was the intention or not. Now, some people have suggested the man has a strange gait, even going so far as suggesting he's a war veteran who was wounded in combat and suffered a permanent limp. But realistically, when a person walks on a structure of this kind, in which there are literally gaps between the ties where you can see 65 or 70 feet below to the water, it's going to affect their gait. What is more than apparent is that this person had the physical capability to cross the bridge at a pace far in excess of what the girls accomplished. He caught up to them in a situation in which they had a head start consisting of half the length of the bridge, give or take. It's fairly obvious the person in question is familiar with this bridge, local, and has traversed it before, perhaps even going back to his own youth when he was the girl's age. This dude moves across the bridge like he's riding a bike. I think he did it when he was a kid. The first element of Bridge Guy I want to address is the way he's moving. He has to cross that bridge swiftly, and he not only looks capable of the task through the benefit of prior repetition, but he also looks very comfortable doing it. He does not look panicked or rushed. In the audio released to us, we hear the voice of a man who is clearly not exhibiting anger or any sort of haste in his tone. As I said before, this crime is almost unfathomably audacious, committed within daytime hours in view of a residence on private property and also within the confines of a trail system in a park where other people walking around could easily see him. This crime is pulled off with precision from beginning to end. He's a phantom. This is not reminiscent of a desperate spontaneous act, but a planned mission by a calculated and competent person. He seems to be very comfortable in these surroundings. Why? Now, on a superficial level, what I notice most strikingly about Bridge Guy is his choice of colors for his clothing. The color palette is decidedly two-tone, though it seems there are likely other elements as well. If I go back to that press conference in which it's announced that two bodies were found in Delphi, what I see is representatives from three Indiana law enforcement agencies. The Delphi police chief is wearing blue. The public information officer from the Indiana State Police is also wearing blue, and the sheriff of Carroll County wears brown. When viewing Bridge Guy, we see he wears blue jeans, a blue coat, and then what appears to be a brown hoodie pulled up over his short-billed brown cap. So, essentially, He's dressed in blue and brown, the same colors law enforcement wears in the state of Indiana. Now, the clothes he's wearing, according to some, look oversized as though they're not his. This is not the case. These clothes are someone's older clothes they packed away in a closet or a box in the attic, meaning they're still in the kind of shape that allows you to wear them, but styles have changed. From the color to the looser, longer fit of the jeans, combined with the glossy nylon-type material of the coat, I see a guy who is, at the time, middle-aged and is wearing his old clothes from when he already would have been a grown man and not a physically fit kid. That makes sense in the context of an older man and not that second sketch that we see that looks nothing like Bridge Guy. On that note, I see the legs of a middle-aged man, one with a belly protruding above. The thing that concerns me is that this man is moving the way a cop moves toward a car that he's just pulled over. He's moving with purpose and haste, but there is no panic because the cop is the authority. I see in this man's behavior that he believes he is the authority and is calm. I ask myself why he has this type of confidence approaching two girls in broad daylight with the intention of killing them. How is this guy able to walk around looking so suspicious and carrying weapons with his coat stuffed like he just robbed the sausages from the meat aisle at a grocery store and do it with such tremendous arrogance and confidence all in broad daylight? It's nuts. I respectfully believe the answer was that as a member of law enforcement and a local, he could utilize available information to create minimal risk in what would otherwise be a crime so audacious you'd have to wonder who would risk it and be able to pull it off with such amazing precision. Now, let's examine this man's approach and why I think he's a member of law enforcement. Again, what do we call the cops? The boys in blue. He's wearing all blue. The sheriff's department wears tall brown hats, and Bridge Guy has a brown hoodie with short-brimmed brown cap riding high atop his head. I believe this apparel was chosen for psychological comfort, meaning since he couldn't be the authority while he was out murdering, he wanted to flaunt the colors associated with it, especially because they intuitively spell authority to the victims as well. Now, about that shit under this guy's coat. Oh my God. We can see this guy has tons of stuff hidden underneath his coat, and likely also under the hoodie beneath it, a setup which causes various bulges to appear across his midsection, particularly the lower part. The end result is that he has what appears to be a giant beer belly, both the result of actually having a protruding belly and also arranging a multitude of items over top of it. Now, it almost looks like the blue coat is cinched closed at the middle, as though there's so much shit hidden within that it was otherwise going to spill out. And I think that's the case. I believe overeating in relation to emotional issues, specifically those that manifested in childhood around Libby's age, have haunted this perpetrator and have made him inclined to overcompensate with food to have good feelings when the abuse he suffered caused the opposite. What happens is that, on a psychological level, because he has an emotional problem leading to overeating and trying to hide the problem, when he puts on this jacket and fills it with things intended to physically kill that child still emotionally living in his head, those things will literally make his gut bigger. They are no different than the food. They're physical tools utilized to accommodate the same emotional problem. So the overeating he does while he's suffering the abuse causes the same effect that stuffing his fucking jacket full of tools to kill the child inside him does, because he is suffering from the same thing. So we get the same result in terms of visuals. Now, when I look at this man's belly, again, I see he's overweight. As a kid, he might have had shame in relation to that. And like Libby, he might have decided to wear a specific type of clothing, aka the tie-dyed shirts, but in his own form, so that his insecurity about what he thought people were seeing would be squashed by the visual of the type of clothing at hand. So let's ask ourselves, does a sheriff wear some type of uniform that tries to show that he is something greater than what he might feel inside? Well, if you were an abused child, if you were the product of an abusive father and wanted to become the sheriff, obviously it would say that you wanted to become the father, because the sheriff is essentially the father of the people working in his department in terms of being the boss. That uniform is no different than Libby's tie-dyed shirt. It is saying something about how he wants to be seen. It is showing people an emotional deficiency. An abused child is often powerless and out of control. And if he grew up in Indiana in a situation in which he had no authority, power, or control, the colors with which he would associate gaining such would be blue and brown. And that's how Bridge Guy is dressed. And of course, it isn't a coincidence that there's a rumor that he was behaving like, or even presenting himself as, some type of member of law enforcement. And like Libby, to disguise the pain inside and show people who he really was, or how he wanted to be seen, he might have chosen a particular kind of shirt, or even a whole uniform, that says, "I'm the authority. I'm in charge. I'm the boss, the father." Libby wanted people to see what was on the inside. And so he, suffering the same, choosing a physically manifested option, is left to hide everything under his jacket and shirt, despite the fact it's grown ludicrously large. I mean, this dude has so much shit packed into the coat. The belly keeps getting bigger and bigger, as though he keeps eating and eating. And it's very simply because that stuff under his jacket, from the belly to everything he wants to use to kill the child, all of that gear, is manifested as the emotional burden he carries around. It's how that burden has grown and become unmanageable. It's manifesting in reality, spilling out of his head. We see this coat seemingly cinched off at the middle, like it's ready to burst or something. He can barely keep the secrets inside it. They're bulging out. They have to get out. They need to. This is all of the emotional baggage he's carrying around, stuffed into his jacket. Now, what in the hell are all of these bulges? Well, my first impression, prior to any analysis, was that it kind of looks like he's wearing a cop's utility belt underneath the coat and above the waistline, and that's the reason the coat needs to be cinched closed. Otherwise, the belt would dip below it. But then I'm like, nah, it's clear. You can see the guy is not wearing a utility belt under the jacket. That would stick out even more. But you know, I do think I'm on the right track here. And I know that Sheriff Tobe Lesenby writes a column for the Comet sometimes. And undoubtedly, I know, one of those columns is going to enlighten me as to the answer. I really believe I'm on the right track with the utility belt. But from a practical standpoint, when I look at him, that's just too large to fit under that coat. So I go looking. I find one of his writings from 2020 documenting utility belt alternatives for law enforcement who have suffered back injuries due to the low-hanging utility belts distributing weight improperly. Apparently, the sheriff's department also offers a vest as an alternative to that, one in which items are stored in compartments across the entirety of your lower midsection rather than on the waistline, thereby redistributing the weight and reducing the chance of a back injury while also reducing the amount of space that the belt will take up. Of course, if you wear one of these, especially under a hoodie with a coat on top, the result would likely be exactly what you see in the Bridge Guy video. There's nothing on his hips, but above them, there are bulges across his midsection, revealing that items are being stored in those locations. So what is housing those items? In this scenario, wearing that vest, a person could conceal everything from a firearm to handcuffs. In fact, just, you know, an interesting note, but in the article, the sheriff distinctly uses two separate photos, one with a man wearing the utility belt and another with the man wearing the vest. In each photo, the man only has one set of handcuffs, and furthermore, only has a handcuff holder suitable for holding one pair. Yet the sheriff leaves a parenthetical in the text that suggests sometimes the vests hold two sets of cuffs. Again, I'm not pointing a finger, but given that the girls were allegedly not discovered bound, and cases of this type most often utilize bindings, while there's also a rumor the sheriff answered a polygraph question in relation to handcuffs inconclusively, I'm very much suspicious. What was that reference of two sets of handcuffs all about, especially given the fact that the visual accommodations didn't support that? They show one set of handcuffs. Why is that reference made to two sets? Now, here is the most interesting element for me in terms of this being a law enforcement officer. Bridge Guy's arm placement. As we see Bridge Guy approach the girls on the video, we're told his hands are in his jeans pockets. But that's not altogether true. We can see his left hand is in his pocket, though not very deeply. That's clear. If we look at the curvature of that left arm going up from the hand, what we see is that it is not curved enough to create a gap between the man's body and his arm where light can get through. But on the right side, what we notice is that his arm looks a little different in terms of positioning. The elbow is clearly more pointed, suggesting that the right hand is farther back than the left hand, and therefore not in his jeans pocket. In fact, when we view that right arm going from the hand up, what we notice is that the sharper angle I just mentioned allows light through a gap on the right side of the body, when in fact there is no such gap on the left side. And that's very troubling because the left side of his body is the one in the shade and the right side of his body is in the light. So if there was any light coming through on the left side, it would be more easily seen. And yet we see none. Only on the right side of his body do we see that light coming through the gap between his arm and his body. The light is specifically coming through because of a gap created by greater curvature of the elbow. So, how would you get that type of angle? It's easy. If you take your hand from a place where it would be resting in your right jeans pocket and move it back along the waistline of your pants a bit, stopping in the place where a gun holster would be located, and specifically where you would draw, then what you notice is that your arm has curved to make that gap which allows light to come through. This man's left hand is in his pocket, but the right hand is in a place where a gun holster would normally be, and curved as though he's preparing to draw. Now, we understand this man likely does have a gun. But guess what? There's no holster in that spot. So why is his hand there as he approaches two people in a situation he knows could involve people fleeing and will definitively involve violence? What he's doing here is what a cop does when drawing his weapon seems imminent. You do not want to draw second, ever. So we have a very calm, authoritative, audacious man wearing the colors of local law enforcement and who looks just like the sheriff, in my opinion, approaching these two girls like he's doing a traffic stop in which two felons with warrants might decide to run or pull a gun. That hand placement suggests he is about to pull a gun. There is no reason for his elbow to be that high. But there is no holster in the place where he has his hand. I believe he is doing this out of habit. I believe he is about to pull a gun, but not from a holster. It's concealed nearby on his body, yet his instincts caused him to position his hand there because that is where his holster has been located for however many decades he's been in law enforcement. Now let's talk about his face. It's very difficult to make out the details, and on a frame-by-frame basis, this guy looks like someone completely different. So again, I think we have to utilize the totality of information. More often than not, what I see is a middle-aged man with a prominent, thick mustache, just like the one Tobe Lesenby had at the time of the crime, and which he changed thereafter. The face is perfectly clean-shaven around it, but the chin remains a strong point of contention as it's difficult to discern whether something is covering it or if the man has a goatee. Let me tell you something. It ain't hard to fake hair on your chin. We shouldn't buy or sell based on that idea. In the Down the Hill podcast, a 2020 interview with Sheriff Lesenby had him revealing that law enforcement, to his knowledge, does not have additional audio between the perpetrator and victims other than bridge guy saying, "Guys, go down the hill." There is apparently more audio of the girls speaking to each other and more video of the perpetrator walking, but according to the sheriff in that interview, there is no additional audio spoken between the perpetrator and the girls other than him saying, "Guys, go down the hill." That limited, efficient interaction without argument by the girls would suggest his argument was made quite clear by way of intimidation, which I believe would most likely be a gun and not a knife. Now, of course, there are rumors that there was extensive conversation between the two parties, and we don't know if the sheriff is telling the truth here. So there might be extensive audio beyond what we have heard. A knife was likely the main tool utilized in their deaths, but nothing has the ability to intimidate and control multiple people like a gun. His direct nature and lack of elaboration tells me that he used the gun to say everything he needed to say, except the words, "Go down the hill." The gun implies cooperation, and then the dialogue delivers the instructions. So, did it happen like that? Or was there more disgust between the two parties? We can't know for sure. We know the rumors. We know what the sheriff said, but we don't know the truth. What I can say, however, is that this is absolutely not how a circumstance of this type would normally transpire. It would normally be the province of a ruse, meaning a fake story in which the perpetrator would pose as someone else, likely an authority figure, in order to keep the girls as calm as possible and cooperative while going to their destination. For instance, in this story, this physical bridge to adulthood is the manifested emotional issue Libby is dealing with. She wants to cross over into adulthood and hasn't reached that place emotionally, so she's here to literally cross the bridge to meet an older guy at the end, someone who symbolizes the love of the father waiting for her, but in an adult context, such as romantic love, instead of still being the child. That place doesn't exist physically. It only exists emotionally, so when this predator puts it on a map for her, and with the symbolic narrative to boot, in the form of the bridge physically taking her to the place she can't get to yet, emotionally, due to her young age, he's going to seem like a magician. And he is. It's all too good to be true. He pulls a rabbit from a hat, but it's just a facade. He's so easily able to do this because it's also what he's doing for himself. He can't manage to transcend or be reborn into adulthood without the hurt child from his past following him emotionally, so he's come here to kill that child symbolically and indulge a manifested ceremonial narrative that finally lays the child to rest. As he won't be doing it inside his head, he'll need to do it in the outside world, so he's going to kill and have a private ceremony in which I'm sure he left items relevant to childhood and symbolic rebirth in his wake. There would have been a religious element, and I believe that's why law enforcement described the crime scene as non-secular. Anyhow, what we can easily see from the manifested narrative here is that the bridge being the thing that physically takes Libby, or both girls, into adulthood is incorrect, and they need to indulge the emotional path instead. Now, remember what I said about the character arc in terms of physical plot? It happens above the bridge, in the light. The emotional narrative, its binary counterpart, takes place in the dark waters of the mirror universe, or unconscious mind, below. So the ruse I would have expected to see would align both practically and in an evolutionary context. Not surprisingly, a rumor surfaced suggesting bridge guys stopped the girls and said, "Guys, you can't cross the bridge up here, it's too dangerous." And it's true, the bridge is restricted, but people just cross it anyway. On an emotional level, the bridge Libby was trying to cross into adulthood was not possible. So she was manifesting a physical solution as a shortcut to get there faster and end her pain. But the path to adulthood is emotional growth, which takes place under the bridge, so to speak. So what I imagine Bridge Guy would have said, as his ruse, is, "Hey, you can't be crossing this bridge, it's too dangerous and it's illegal," which is exactly the situation a girl would have put herself in by drawing a predator there in her ignorance because she was immature. In order to reach adulthood, we must be put through the trials and tribulations of the abyss below and prove we can float through emotional ascension when exposed to those dark waters. So this guy would say, "You can't cross the bridge, it's too dangerous, and instead you have to go back to where you came from, aka childhood, and prove you can build that bridge and float above by crossing the creek below, which equates to the rough seas upon which Christ learns to walk on water as he crosses from his childhood into the place of becoming the Father." So this guy is going to take them down the hill to their emotional world, and at gunpoint, force them to cross the creek at its shallowest point, aka walk on water, mimicking the maturation process to adulthood. He's saying, "You have to do this first. It's how the bridge is created that allows you to ascend, aka the reason the bridge above is too dangerous right now." Right? Because the bridge is rotting, and what could happen? You could fall. What it's saying is that on an emotional level, these girls are not old enough in a place where they are able to create that bridge, and it's dangerous. And then when they reach the other side, having physically manifested the necessary emotional steps to get to the place they seek, he kills the child inside them, so to speak, and it's gone forever, which is exactly what he wants. Libby wanted to leave her childhood behind. He did that for her, and in the worst, most narcissistic, predatory way. But it's because somebody did it to him. It's the cycle of abuse. Wrath followed by mercy. He lures her there so he can watch the kid he once was, and still is emotionally, desperately trying to cross the metaphorical bridge into adulthood, escaping the abusive father that remains lurking over his shoulder and gaining on him. He wanted somebody to know how it felt. That man coming up behind them was the manifestation of the man who had always been coming up behind him, lurking over his shoulder, killing him emotionally. So he got his revenge and, more importantly, finally became understood by telling this physical narrative laden with symbolism. What really frightens me here is that the most likely reason one would forego the implementation of a ruse is that if the person knew the victims, he wouldn't be able to manipulate his authority. Meaning, if he was a school teacher they knew, he couldn't be like, "Yeah, I'm really a cop." Yet if he was a member of law enforcement and they knew him, he wouldn't need to say shit, and anything said would be pointless because it's clear his intentions are not of the lawful variety. If he knew them and they saw him for who he was and also respected his authority already, they'd be more inclined to cooperate. I don't know if this was a member of law enforcement or not, but after they reviewed the video and audio, Sheriff Lesenby became a suspect who required an alibi and a polygraph. That's not comforting. Sheriff Lesenby himself suggested that the remainder of the Bridge Guy video was not released because it's not believed that it offers the public any additional evidentiary value. I'm sorry? You have video of a man who killed two children, and you make a decision to edit that video to only show part of what you have, withholding the entirety of this perpetrator's likeness from the public under the guise that it has no value. Excuse me? But it's video of the fucking guy who killed two girls. The only reason I can think of that the sheriff would be so inclined to believe video evidence had no value to the public in terms of identification is if what was shown in that video didn't dispel the existing rumors surrounding him as a suspect. If other agencies were led to deem him a suspect by way of the totality of audio and visual evidence beyond what you and I have seen, why is it withheld from the public in favor of a sketch of a teen with bushy hair who is abso-fucking-lutely not the man in the video who looks like the sheriff running the investigation? Superintendent Carter of the Indiana State Police at the 2019 press conference pointed at the new sketch and said, quote, "This is the killer." I'm sorry? But with all due deference, no, it is fucking not. No, it's not. The best thing they can do is release whatever else they have, even if it's only another second of video. There has been no transparency, in my opinion, because they can't afford to offer anything beyond what they already have. Not because it suits the integrity of the case, but instead because it accommodates the integrity of law enforcement without bringing them into question. It's wrong, it's unacceptable, and undoubtedly it is exactly why this case is unsolved and going nowhere. This is a cold case. They keep saying people are working on it and it's not a cold case, but the truth is that people are working on this case and it is a cold case because they are trapped in the abusive cycle that is coming from within the investigation. Again, what really needs to be addressed is the validity of having a tip line that goes to the office run by a man who looks exactly like the Delphi killer and was a suspect in the case, a case in which he admits mistakes were made involving alibis being faked. Good Lord, what the hell am I missing here? Is it fear that has everybody saying, oh, this bridge guy seems like an authority figure, a crossing guard, a fireman, a teacher? Nobody says cop. Nobody. Even after the sheriff is made a suspect in the investigation, and by way of a totality of information beyond what you and I know, I still have people heckling me like, oh, you're an idiot if you think it's the sheriff. I am? You sure about that? I need clarification from law enforcement about why Sheriff Tobe Lesenby, who was made a suspect, showed up to the press conference to announce the bodies had been found and behaved as strangely as he did. Why did he shiver repeatedly? Why was he severely paranoid about people and cameras looking at him? Why did his eyes shut and look like they rolled into the back of his head after someone used the word liberty? Why did he almost appear to pass out cold and be on the verge of a panic attack? Why did his mouth seemingly open involuntarily during one of those shivers and start speaking, and it looked exactly like the frames in the Bridge Guy video where his mouth curls open and everybody's like, oh, he's spitting or smoking a cigarette? He's talking to himself. Watch the two bodies found in Delphi conference video, and you will see the sheriff open his mouth and move it, talking to himself. Something is wrong. There is a very big problem. Why does he seem to be having a deeply emotional experience being relived in his mind, one that causes shaking and shivering and excessive attention to the radio wire hanging over his shoulder? He is in fucking outer space during this conference, and the other cops look at him multiple times like, bro, you are the most suspicious man on earth. And guess what? He becomes a suspect. I have absolutely no doubt that video led to him becoming a suspect, but his behavior is absolutely disturbing. If anyone in law enforcement saw that video, he would become a suspect. And it happened, for good reason. When you listen to behavioral experts in the criminal world, what you'll sometimes hear is that the behavior of perpetrators will change dramatically after the crime, specifically because they are distracted by reliving the guilt over and over again in their heads. When I watch the video of the sheriff at that press conference the day the bodies are found, when he first realizes there is a video of the perpetrator, his behavior becomes prototypically that which these behavioral experts are referring to. There is so much more bullshit going on here. I don't know where anybody is coming up with Bridge Guy having hair. It's ridiculous. I don't see any fucking hair. Yet what I do believe I see on Bridge Guy's face, and very prominently, is a pair of glasses. Particularly the high, tight, minimalistic kind favored by law enforcement because they're less likely to be bulky and inhibit peripheral vision. The style I believe I see in close-ups is the same style Tobe Lesenby wore in that time period. There are photos of him online wearing them. In that press conference I just mentioned, the day after the murders, he has the same mustache as Bridge Guy. Subsequent to that incident, he reshaped the mustache for a different look, and later grew a beard. In the 2019 press conference, the stash had been thinned out, and he lost the glasses. I'm not saying it's abnormal to change your appearance, but in line with suspicious things people do after committing crimes, he did in fact change his appearance and specifically made sure his mustache no longer matched the perpetrator's. Now, I believe Bridge Guy is also wearing a hoodie and a short-brimmed cap, not because he has hair, but specifically because he doesn't. And because if the sides of the head were exposed, we would know that, and also see the stems of his glasses going back over his ears. The witness by Freedom Bridge didn't say anything about seeing a man wearing glasses. So why would the perpetrator have put on glasses after seeing the witness earlier, right? Why wouldn't he have been wearing them then? Was it a matter of identification? No. If you normally wear glasses and you need to walk across that rotting bridge with all sorts of gaps in it, then you're going to need to wear your glasses as opposed to when you're on the trail and there is no such danger. I don't think this person is hiding his hair. He's hiding his head. I'm a bald guy, and as a bald guy, I can tell you the reason you would do such a thing is because you can't change that appearance overnight. If they see a bald guy in the video, it's not like he can go home and grow long hair out overnight. Like I said, a man who wears glasses wouldn't need to wear them on the trail in broad daylight, but if he wanted to cross the rickety old bridge with missing ties at high speed, he'd be wise to wear them. And I believe I see them under his cap, most strongly evidenced by the notch protruding from a very specific place on the nose. Now, if you wear glasses, where do they sit on the nose? And on the glasses themselves, what is that notch in the center between the lenses called? There you go. They're both called the bridge, right? The man's face is the light above. The glasses are the mirror universe. And what's between them, like it is in this narrative I dissected? The bridge. Okay, so I'm going to cut it off right there. Thanks for joining me, and I will be back with you next Tuesday for part 4.